Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Anna Cale. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Indeed, indeed. Now, you're an arts and culture writer who specialises in classic film and TV. You have a book out called The Real Diana Dawes that's available to buy from all good bookshops, as I understand it.
Absolutely, yes.
And people by just searching your name will find many an interesting article written by you. In particular, one that stood out for me was your 10 great British seaside films for the BFI.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was great fun to write. So, yeah, absolutely.
I imagine. So, welcome to the show. You're going to do three films that have impacted everything in your adult life, a format that I've been playing with since December and having a lot of fun with, I should add. But before we do, let's talk about some of your stuff. Let's start with The Real Diana Dawes. This is a question I ask a lot of documentary filmmakers when they do a documentary, where obviously you go in with a perceived idea of something and then you make a film and then you come out the other side. So I imagine when you're writing a biography, there's a perception you might enter the process with, and then there's maybe some change in that perception as you go. So what for you was the biggest surprise and or revelation once you started to concentrate on writing a book about Diana Dawes that you might not have had you not done gone through the process?
Yeah, so there was a lot to learn about Diana Dawes. I thought I knew her and I thought I knew her work, but actually there's so many more layers to her career and to her as a person and the journey she went on as a person. So it was wonderful to be able to build that picture of her. But also for me, one of the things that really stood out was I'd seen, you know, various things about her. I'd read other biographies, not recently perhaps, but certainly, you know, in the past that there have been biographies written about her.
Yeah.
But they're all from a certain perspective. They're all, you know, from a male perspective. And there weren't many books or articles written about from a female perspective. And that was something I wanted to bring into that kind of study of her and her work.
Yeah.
Was a different perspective. My perspective as a woman and now looking back on her and the social journey, you know, that she was involved with, as well as you know, the time she lived in was a fascinating time in British cinema, but also in British life. And she navigated that, you know, in a really interesting way. So it was great to, I guess, kind of unpick the jigsaw around her and her work and her life. And, you know, there'd often been focus on maybe the more salacious aspects of her personal life, obviously in articles or books written about her. So I wanted to really dig deeper and kind of really try to get to understand her as a person and as a performer, and kind of build that jigsaw back together again, you know, and kind of see where I got to with the research that I did. But luckily for me, Diana Dawes wrote a lot herself. She was a very witty and intelligent woman, really keen to kind of get her own story out there and write herself. You know, she wrote articles, she wrote a number of books herself as well. So it was great to kind of revisit and visit those and kind of read her own view of herself and how that changed over time. So there was loads of great source materials I could use for the book. And it was great to kind of piece that all together to give what I wanted to do is give a bit of an introduction to her as a performer, but also into her place in British cinema and as a screen star, and then kind of maybe set people off on a journey to find out more about her and her work. So if you know, one person kind of finds her and watches some of her films as a result of reading the book, then I'm really happy, because that's what I wanted to do, is kind of, you know, just put her story out there for people to kind of read and enjoy and hopefully find out more as a result.
Nice one. Nice one. I mean, she strikes me, if I think about what I might think of her, is somebody who sort of trailblazed the kind of, you know, the siren, as it were. You know, she was a kind of, you know, a Marilyn Monroe figure in a headline tabloidy way. But also she was a trailblazer on the other end as well, is that she carried on performing and acting as she matured. It didn't just stop for her then. And obviously this is a recurring thing that's still sadly discussed to this day, that there's like a shelf life for female actors. And the fact is she did actually still carry on to be present in film and TV after the glamour years, I suppose, for want of a better expression.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. She had very interesting different chapters to her career. She kept coming back. You know, she had knockbacks, and she had kind of difficulties in terms of kind of, I guess, pursuing the career she perhaps wanted, but she kept going, she kept working. She was able to create a really interesting, nuanced career, both on screen, on cinema, and also in TV. She did a lot of TV work as well, particularly in later years when she was allowed to kind of take on those character roles, and kind of maybe the focus wasn't just on, you know, her beauty. I mean, she was a beautiful woman, very glamorous woman, and she remained so all through her life. But, you know, there was a focus more on her acting skills, you know, certainly from the 70s onwards. And she really kind of showed and demonstrated what a good actor she was. And it, you know, she could have gone on to do so many other, you know, wonderful things had she not died, you know, obviously so young. It would have been fascinating to see what she went on to do, because I think there's so much more that she could give in terms of her acting and her personality. You know, she was great as a, you know, a chat show guest or, you know, quiz show, whatever it was, you know, she turned a hand to. She was great, and she obviously loved what she did. And that really came across in her performances, which is why people absolutely loved her. You know, there's so much outpouring of love for her when I started the book, and people getting in touch and saying, oh, I remember on this, I remember on that, you know, really just genuine kind of affection for her, you know, as a personality and as an actor.
And what when you went back over her own writing then, what was your favourite discovery of that you unearthed, that you put in the book?
I think there were some books you could kind of see she was kind of maybe... you know, she was after the salacious. So she understood how things worked. You know, she was very savvy, and she understood what was the expectation was in terms of the kind of output she might put out there. Yeah. For example, one of the titles was The A to Z of Men, which was an interesting read. And there were other titles like that. But actually, her second, she did two autobiographies.
Okay.
One when she was incredibly young. It came out, I think, in the early 60s, called Swinging Doors. And if you can get hold of a copy, it's a wonderful book. Absolutely fascinating read from a younger perspective. And, you know, her to then, you know, varied and interesting career. But, you know, she was still only, 30 at that time. If that, and, you know, she'd done so much up to that point. And that was an interesting, entertaining read. But her second autobiography, which came out in 1980, is really interesting to kind of see her reflecting on her own career and her own journey, and kind of the different perspectives she brings kind of later on. And the two books side by side, it's really interesting to kind of see the difference in the approach.
Yeah, I imagine you've got, on the one hand, you've got modernism and the birth of popular culture. And I guess by 1980, we're entering the postmodern era where we're beginning to reflect on a history of popular culture. You know, it's got like a long tail then, hasn't it, at that point? It's no longer surprising us. We're trying to manufacture it like never before, I think, by 1980.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another key interest for you in terms of writing, and we'll come across this filmmaker in your three selections, is Bill Forsyth. So do you want to talk about what you've been doing in terms of writing and work about him?
Yeah, so after I finished the Diana Dawes book, we were still in lockdown, and we were still kind of, you know, in the kind of the throes of all that. And I wanted another project to focus on. And I'd always wanted to write more about Bill Forsyth as a filmmaker. And one of the things, again, I kind of reflected on, there wasn't much out there in terms of kind of re-evaluation of his films, or kind of a look at his whole career. You know, obviously people focus on certain films, you know, Gregory's Girl or Local Hero, which are wonderful films, you know, absolutely, you know, lovely examples of his work. But he, you know, he's made more than that, you know, and he's made several films which people kind of haven't noticed, or they haven't seen, or they've kind of forgotten about. So I wanted to do a bit of a kind of focus on him, but from a personal perspective. So I did it as a kind of, I guess, a series of essays initially.
Yeah.
I just kind of started writing. You know, you kind of, you write, you start writing, and you just kind of keep writing. I also did a series of podcasts as well, focusing on each of his films. So it's obviously starting with That Sinking Feeling, his first film, right through to, you know, the latest film that he's made, which was in the 90s. You know, he hasn't made a film for a very long time, although he says he still intends to. So I wanted to look at each of those films, get on a guest who, you know, I knew maybe had an interest in him or might bring an interesting perspective to those particular films, and have a conversation about, you know, the film and what they meant to them, or, you know, what they kind of got from watching or rewatching that particular film. And the essays, kind of, I did an essay per film and kind of pulled them together and into a little kind of, I guess, a booklet of kind of an illustrated booklet. And I worked with a wonderful illustrator called Eli Allison, who created these wonderful illustrations for each of the films to kind of bring into that illustrated book. Absolutely beautiful drawings.
Oh, fantastic. So
it was about kind of celebrating him in a visual way as well, and what the feel that you get from his films, as well as kind of the written kind of form from me and my feelings towards each of those films kind of in turn. So it was great. It was a lovely project to kind of do. And I was really pleased to kind of get it out there for people to enjoy. The podcasts obviously are available on all good podcast providers. It's called 10,000 Grains of Sand, which is a reference to Local Hero, which obviously we will talk about potentially on later.
Yeah, no, I was fortunate enough, because a film I'd never seen of his just dropped on Netflix a few months back. It may even be a year back now. Comfort and Joy, which I'd never seen before.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favourites.
Yeah.
Best Christmas film ever, that Comfort and Joy, I think.
Well, I was just struck by, I mean, and I guess it's one of them things about when, the importance of making British cinema about British life is that, looking at it now, it's a genuine social history document as much as it is a piece of history, you know, part of the cinema canon come out of Britain. Actually, when you look at it, you get a view of British life, because it's a snapshot in time, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's mid-80s Britain. It's kind of, it's an interesting looking film from that point of view. Beautifully shot. I love that film. I could talk about that film as well for ages, but I won't.
Well, look, I'll put links in the show notes to all the things that we've highlighted here. And we'll move on swiftly to three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. I've got the list of three. Now, for the benefit of someone that hasn't heard this before, I'll just quickly go over the rules, and obviously for your benefit too. The rules are quite simple. We're gonna go through the three films, but we're only gonna go through them 5 minutes at a time. So I'm gonna set my timer, which is what I'm doing now while I avoid eye contact with Anna. and then when the clock gets to 5 minutes, we will hear this sound, Anna. You can hear that at your end, okay?
I can, yeah. Fantastic. I might ignore it though. I might keep talking.
No, plenty of people do. But it's at least a chance for me, passive aggressively, to say time's up on that film. And the most important thing is, it's about making sure that we at least give core attention to each film. Yeah. And that's the whole point of it, really. And a little bit of fun with the Jeopardy. I can do them in the order you've given me, or I can do them in the order of the release. Which would you prefer?
Oh, goodness. The order I gave them in, I think.
Okay, cool.
Because I think that was a natural kind of progression in my mind.
Right then. Your first film on your list is Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. Do you want to tell us where that fits into your film-watching life and how it had an impact on you?
Yeah, I discovered Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, I think, as my gateway to film and cinema, and kind of thinking, wow, this is you know, an amazing experience. I was in my teens when I first saw it, and I actually saw it. I'd read the book in my early teens. My English teacher, when I was at school, kind of latched on to the fact that I was obviously looking for more challenging reading at that age, and recommended Saturday Night and Sunday Morning to me to read. And it was a wonderful book. And as I wrote, I kind of started to then voraciously read all the books from that period, you know, the kind of the kitchen sink type, you know, Angry Young Men books that were out there. I think I cleaned out my local library pretty quick in terms of kind of, you know, the books that are available. And then I started to move on to watch the films. You know, I found out the films had been made of some of the books, and started watching them. And Saturday Night and Sunday Morning was an absolute revelation to me in terms of just the way that it captured the spirit of the book, but then even more so, you know, it's such an impactful film. Mm. It's a great story, you know, it's very true to the book, but the performance of Albert Finney in the lead role of Arthur Seton, which is just astounding. It's so energetic, so raw, and yeah, just like nothing that I'd ever been seen before, I think, in British cinema. This was something incredibly new.
Mm.
It wasn't the first, you know, of the British New Wave films, but for me, it's the most impactful and the most interesting to watch, you know, the way it was put together. So Carol Rice is the director, you know, kind of his background in social realist filmmaking and the free cinema movement, and bringing all that to the screen and really absolutely encapsulating what the British New Wave was about kind of in that film. And it's such a great story. You know, Arthur Seton is an absolute anti-hero. Very different to any kind of, you know, kind of star of a film that you all main character in a film that you might have seen before. And it just was, a breathtaking ride, I think. And you can see the influence of it, you know, kind of in other cinema now. You know, the impact of that film in particular, I think, is the one that's really kind of struck a chord with people, with, you know, with filmmakers as they then, you know, approach kind of making their own films. You can see that now, you know, right through time, from when it came out in 1960 right through to now, really, with some of the British filmmakers that are working now, and the spirit that they bring to that work, I think, has really been informed by Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. I just think it is a wonderful, wonderful example of how you can really bring something new to film and really kind of just turn everything on its head. And the main performances are fantastic. You know, Albert Finney, obviously, in that lead role, but also Rachel Roberts in a role within that film. I think she's fantastic and really, I guess, underrated star of kind of the British New Wave.
Right.
In terms of, you know, people focus on the men and, you know, the kind of the male kind of, you know, roles with it within that British kind of film movement. But she's wonderful. She's wonderful in this. She's wonderful in this Sporting Life as well, which obviously was a film that came out in 1963. A real underrated, wonderful actor. She's just amazing. And I think she brings a really nuanced, interesting performance to her role as Brenda in this film in particular. But yeah, those two together on the screen are just wonderful.
Yeah, I'm guessing there with that, you sort of, I guess for the popular culture at the time, it was enough of a revolution.
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And for us to have working class people front and centre, yes, being angry at the world, not let alone, absolutely, the fact that we could say there's angry men and women in the working class culture. I mean, that, you know, and 1960 is a really pivotal year because you've got Peeping Tom, you've got Psycho, you know, there's like, you know, British films, really, British filmmakers are really ripping things up, aren't they?
Absolutely. But this was authentic, you know, this was a really authentic film, you know, from a working class perspective.
Mm.
I think some of the slightly earlier film, Room at the Top, is a good example of that. It was trying, you know, it was trying to get there, but it wasn't quite there. There was a kind of staginess to it that, you know, just kind of didn't quite get to where this film did in terms of kind of having that energy And that kind of really authentic approach to demonstrating, you know, the realities of working class life, but not in a really downtrodden way. Yeah. You know, Arthur is absolutely enjoying himself. He's enjoying his life, and he's out there and he's just demonstrating what it was like to be a working class man with a bit of money in his pocket in 1960 or, you know, the late 50s, early 60s. And it just, yeah, it's just, yeah, a wonderful example of how film can have a real impact, I think.
Yeah, no, it's the seeing the liberation, I think, as much as anything else, of and getting it documented, because obviously we get used to high society and middle class life all the time, still to this day, unfortunately. And the idea that if you show working, it must mean it must be toil, it must be hard. The idea that you're not just surviving, you're actually thriving, is almost as rebellious as the, just the film itself, you know.
Yeah, the rest is propaganda, as Arthur Seaton says.
Right then, the alarm has gone for 5 minutes, so moving swiftly along, but going back 2 decades to a very different type of movie, a very Hollywood movie, but with a very strong text to it, is His Girl Friday from 1940.
Yeah, so I started watching kind of screwball comedies again in my teens. I mean, you probably tell, you know, my teenage years were really important in terms of kind of that introduction to film and getting really excited about cinema and kind of really just watching everything, you know, that kind of came along.
The whole point of this podcast is to tap into that rich scene of discovery.
Absolutely. And I think the screwball comedies were just like the pinnacle of what, you know, the clever kind of wry dialogue, the kind of the really clever screenplays, just the wonderful stories, the acting, the directing, everything kind of comes together on the screen in a really kind of smooth, professional way. But they're so fun, you know, there's so much fun, so much enjoyment to be had from them. And I think from a perspective of being a teenage girl, you know, I saw on screen, you know, strong female characters, or strong female leads in those films. And in particular, His Girl Friday was the standout film for me. Rosalind Russell in the main role as Hildy was just wonderful. When she came on the screen, I was just mesmerised by her and her performance. But she absolutely has equal billing with Cary Grant in this film. And that's the same, you know, across the kind of, you know, the rest of the kind of films in this kind of genre, I guess, is that kind of equal billing, you know, the male-female kind of, you know, the scattergun dialogue, the kind of the way that they interact, the cleverness and the deftness in which they perform. Mm. What is really clever, interesting roles for women. And I think it was a really fascinating time for women in cinema and in film, and wonderful performances like Russell in this film, but obviously Katharine Hepburn as well in Bring Up Baby, or, you know, some of the other films, just wonderful examples, you know, to kind of set. And I absolutely wanted to be Rosalind Russell in this film. You know, she was clever, she was witty, she was really kind of like engaging. But also she was a newspaper reporter, which is what I wanted to be at that time. You know, she was absolutely living the life that I wanted for myself. And I, you know, I absolutely loved seeing this film and kind of seeing that story played out. It's just great. They're just great fun, but really intelligent as well, I think, in the way that the stories are put across. You know, they are romantic. They're romantic films, but told in quite a different way to how I think people experience romance and romantic comedies now.
Yeah.
You know, things have kind of shifted, but maybe not for the better in terms of how those kind of stories are perceived. And I think, you know, romantic comedies are incredibly important in terms of film kind of history. And, you know, they're often underplayed and downplayed in terms of their importance. And there isn't as much study of them. There isn't as much focus, but actually they're really important for people because people engage, they see themselves, they see their own kind of stories, maybe. You know, they're a wonderful kind of way to kind of engage people in cinema. And I think often people, you know, they kind of underestimate the impact that they can have. Mm. But I think done well, a romantic comedy is an absolutely wonderful thing.
I think, unfortunately, at some point in the, I think by the 90s, the marketing people sort of ruined the idea of romantic comedy being a serious thing by using this expression, you know, a chick flick as a way of marketing it. So suddenly it had to then play to some sort of femininity thing. I mean, it's interesting you chose this film because a filmmaker called Paige Feldman, she came on and did 5 boss bitch romantic comedies, of which this was one. And it's really interesting to think of a 1940s film being the progressive text as opposed to one from, say, 90, you know, 40 years later that was just kowtowing to a kind of what a film for women in a film for men. You know, you had You had action, you had Stallone and Schwarzenegger for men, and you had these other films for women almost, like, you know.
Yeah, it's crazy. And yeah, it really, yeah, we just turned it on its head, really. You know, these roles, you know, Russell in this film in particular, you know, these are strong, clever women. And, you know, I wanted to be her and I wanted to experience romance in the way that she was experiencing it on screen. You know, I absolutely wanted to find someone who was my, you know, my equal, you know, in terms of kind of, you know, the witty one-liners and kind of, you know, just having that kind of really kind of warmth that obviously comes through from the films as well. There's always a wonderful payoff as well. And it always ends so beautifully. You know, there's always this wonderful coming together of the storyline and those characters. And yeah, just lovely telling of a story, you know, in each of these films. But in His Girl Friday in particular, I just love it. The pace of it is wonderful.
Do you remember when you first saw this, do you remember that sort of thinking this isn't normal? You know, like, you know, what was this is, I'm seeing... Yeah. The male female cast being given equal billing. Could you sense
absolutely.
That?
Yes, because I'd seen, like, at that stage probably some of the John Hughes films of the 80s, you know, kind of Pretty in Pink or those kind of films, or similar films where there's a young woman, there's a young man, but it's, the focus is on the man and the male experience. The women are often, you know, sidelined, and even when they are the focus, it's a bit naff and it's a bit like, all she wants to do is go to the prom or get my, you know, it's like, no, sorry, that's not for me. I don't get anything from that. But when I saw this, I was like, yeah, that's it. That's what I want. That's what I want to see. I want to see those women. They're the stories I want to focus on. And yeah, it's kind of I think it's ebbed and flowed over the years. Obviously, Nora Ephron was a great writer for women and female characters and great films, you know. But When Harry Met Sally is a wonderful film, wonderful screenplay that kind of brings those characters. It's just lovely. And it reminds me in some ways of these films in terms of the way that he plays those characters off against each other. But yeah, they're few and far between still, you know, even now. We need a resurgence, I think, of those kind of strong female-led romantic comedies that don't just focus on dresses or whatever.
Well, I mean, there's some of the John Hughes ones now where they're just like this is just like a film about stalking. It's not,
yeah.
It's not, there's no romance. It's just somebody determined to get someone to say yes, and you kind of go,
exactly.
Okay,
yeah, yeah.
Right then, moving into your third choice, which is also, as we've established in the preamble, is one of your specialist subjects. It's Bill Forsyth's Local Hero from 1983. Where'd you start with that? What was that as a discovery for you?
Well, this is probably the most personal of all of my choices.
Okay.
So as a film, it's a wonderful film. You know, I love Bill Forsyth's films. It's a great film. But also it's a very personal film because this is the film that connects me to my dad.
Wow.
So it's his favourite film. And we kind of... we bond and connect through our love of this film. It's kind of played out over the years in terms of when, you know, our relationship sometimes can be a bit up and down and it's kind of, you know, sometimes we don't quite get each other. Hmm. But then we come back to this and this is our anchor, this film.
Oh, amazing.
You know, we talk about this film, we talk about Burt Lancaster. So my dad has always maintained that it's his mantra and it'll probably be on his gravestone that there hasn't been a decent film since Burt Lancaster died. and yeah, he's very kind of staunch in his view that they don't make films like they used to. But, you know, with the case of Local Hero, he's probably right in some ways. You know, he introduced me to this film when I was, again, in my teens, made me sit down and watch it.
Mm.
You know, as an education, you know, it was this and there were other things that, you know, he'd give me a lecture on the small faces as well. And, you know, in terms of music and it's all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But Local Hero, I absolutely loved it when I saw it. And I was probably, you know, again, maybe 12 or 13.
Okay.
Maybe not the target audience for this film, but I the warmth and the kind of the loveliness of the story and the way that the film is made and the characters and the cast, and it's just lovely. And it really got me interested in thinking more about Bill Forsyth's films. And I've, you know, obviously as a result of that interest in his films, it's kind of grown over time and I've seen them when I can. Often, you know, his other films are not as available as Local Hero is or Gregory's Girl. But yeah, kind of seeking out more of his work as a result. But it's this film that I always kind of come back to and I must have seen it. I mean, I don't know how many times. It's probably the film I've seen the most,
okay.
I would say, over time. And when I'm in need of comfort or when I'm in need of maybe, a kind of re-anchoring or something like that, yeah, this is the film I'll come back to and kind of watch. It's magical. I think it's a magical film, both from the way it's made,
yeah,
and that kind of a bit of a magical realist kind of perspective on life, you know, kind of brought into this story and into this this world that he creates in Local Hero. But also it's magical for me in terms of kind of the emotions that it brings out. Mm. And I know it's the same for a lot of people. They do genuinely have a warmth and a love for Local Hero, mm. which you don't see, you know, for the many films, really. You know, that real just kind of genuine love for it, I think.
Absolutely. So what is it, do you think, about Bill Forsyth as a filmmaker that he manages to pull that off? Because, I mean, to a lesser degree, but I think to the same extent, he achieves that with all the films I've seen of his. So yeah. what is it about him as a filmmaker, do you think, that he's getting so right about, I guess, about the human condition, I guess, is what...
Yeah, I think that's what it is, about the human condition. And that's the theme that I think runs through all of his films, is that kind of focus on the individual journey and the conflicts within, you know, that person. He's very funny as well. Mm. The films are very funny, very warm, but funny in a really kind of human way. You know, they're not condescending. They're not kind of trying to be clever. They're just, there's a genuine human warmth and kind of comedy that's created from that within yeah. them.
I think even though there's like a real drama to it, I think that a lot of what he does is he offers us hope in the stories he wants to tell. I think it's never mean-spirited, is it?
It's never mean-spirited. It's really there are small stories told in, you know, sometimes in a kind of quite a small way, but actually with Local Hero there's a you know, kind of, it's maybe his biggest film in terms of scale, you know, in terms of the way obviously it's shot and you know, it was a wonderful opportunity for him, I think, to really kind of demonstrate what he could do as a filmmaker. But in every film, you know, there is that kind of, like you say, that focus on the human condition and someone's journey through that. And the just natural human comedy, I think, kind of comes through as well. And one thing I always love, and it's particularly seen in Local Hero, are the side characters. You know, it's not just one person's journey that is the focus of the film. The film is made up of all the sum of its parts in terms of all these small elements that kind of come through. The side characters, the little kind of recurring motifs in some of his films. You know, the penguin walking around in Gregory's Girl Around the School, for example, or, you know, in Local Hero, there's, you know, the renaming of the boat every 5 minutes and the repainting, the way the locals react to, obviously, you know, the character of Matt coming into the town, just all these little elements, which I think make it so warm and lovely and kind of a wonderful watch. And I think that's what kind of comes through in all of his films. And I wish he'd made more of them. I think it's lovely to be able to kind of focus on it on each one, because each one is different, brings something different. But, you know, there's a lovely kind of feel of the filmmaker through all of his films, I think.
Yeah, no, I think he ends up being a very underrated British filmmaker in the end. I mean, is he on record as saying why he's not made more films?
No, he's quite a kind of you know, he's not out there all the time. He's quite a quiet man. Mm. You know, he's kind of just living his life and, you know, kind of occasionally he'll reemerge. And maybe
I guess it's in a way, it's a bit like Terence Davis in Liverpool, isn't he, in that sense then?
Yeah, possibly, yeah. But Housekeeping is a beautiful film. And I know I'm focusing on Local Hero in this conversation, but Housekeeping is just beautiful. A wonderful telling of a beautiful book and really underrated. And I wish more people had seen that film.
Yeah, including me. You know, I'll have to add myself to that list.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely have to seek it out. It's hard to find out sometimes, but it was reissued a couple of years ago on Blu-ray. And it's beautiful. And yeah, he's got a lovely eye, you know, kind of for what makes a good human story and a good human centered film. But yeah, I wish he had made, there were some films maybe he maybe shouldn't have made towards the end of his career, you know, maybe kind of if he'd had more opportunities that he might have kind of sought out, you know, and kind of worked on other things. But yeah, he's a great example of a quietly unique filmmaker.
Well, I'm glad to shine a light on him for the people that listen to this podcast who might not have had him at the front and centre of their mind. I'll just run through your three films. So it's Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, 1960, His Girl Friday, 1940, and Local Hero, 1983. Your book, The Real Diana Dawes, is available in all good bookshops. And it your is. Bill Forsyth podcast is called what again?
It's called 10,000 Grains of Sand.
10,000 Grains of Sand. I will put links in the show notes to all that. And it just gives me to say thank you very much. Give you time on the BritFlix podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
My pleasure.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.